Hello and welcome to Mr. Crowder's World. This podcast is all about the physics of motion. If you stand still without moving, then you're going nowhere. So it should make sense that you're going no speed. But what is speed? How do you calculate it? You know how people say miles per hour when they talk about how fast a car goes? That's a clue to the math for calculating speed. Miles per hour, kilometers per hour, meters per second, these are all units for speed. The thing they all have in common is distance is being divided by time. Since time is on the bottom, or the denominator of the fraction, it is the independent variable. This should make sense because you cover a distance in a time, and in or per in math means divided by. It also means that time is the independent variable, and distance is dependent on how much time went by. Another way to look at this is that time just passes by at its own rate without you affecting it, but the distance you go in some time is what you can change, not the time. Therefore, when you graph distance versus time, the time will always be on the x-axis, where the independent variable goes. So, let's say that you want to graph a moving object that starts at 0, goes 3 meters in 2 seconds, and then slows to 1 meter in 4 seconds, and then stops for 3 seconds, and then speeds back up to 6 meters in 1 second. Each new speed just connects straight to the last one. This type of graph is called linear, since it's a straight line, though the slope changes with each change of speed. Another term to be aware of when dealing with speed is velocity. Velocity is just speed, though it also involves direction. So you could make the speed of 3 meters per second be a velocity by adding the direction northeast. Now what if your speed or velocity changes inside of a second? How do you subdivide this change in speed? We call this change in speed or velocity over time acceleration. Acceleration can be positive or negative. It's negative when something slows down or decelerates. So speeding up and slowing down are both a way to accelerate. And there is also a third way to accelerate, turning. But why? Can't you go the same speed while turning? Technically, any change in direction is a change in velocity. And if you change velocity over time, then you accelerate. But there's another reason. I like to illustrate this one by having my students line up in front of the room. Then they have to try to stay in a straight line as they turn across the room, from the front of the room all the way to the side of the room, then back to the front again. We imagine that it's a room-sized car with axles as wide as the room. They realize that the outside of the turn goes much faster than the inside. If it's true for something that big, then it's also true for any size, no matter how small. Even a person, your left side goes slightly slower than your right when you turn left. Since part of you goes faster than the other in the same amount of time, then part of you is accelerating compared to another part. Thus, turning is accelerating. The units of accelerating are distance per time per time. This is because speed is distance over time, and speed changing in a time is distance per time over time. Mathematically speaking, dividing time into speed is dividing a fraction by a fraction. Distance over time divided by time over 1. Now, to divide two fractions, you flip the second and multiply. So now you have distance over time times 1 over time, which equals distance divided by time squared. That's why you will see acceleration expressed two different ways, distance over time squared and distance over time per time. Now, what about graphing acceleration? If you use the same variables of time and distance that we used with speed, then a very strange thing happens with a constant acceleration. It's not a straight line. It makes a nice curve. Why is that? Let's say that you accelerated by increasing your speed by 4 meters per second each second. That means that if you went 4 meters that first second, then you would increase the distance by 4 more meters the second second, making it 8 meters. That next second. The third then is 12 meters, etc. So the result is a constantly speeding up graph, a curve that rises upwards and always gets steeper. The other way to graph acceleration is to use speed versus time. Time is still the independent variable, and speed in this case is the dependent variable. This way, if you have a constantly changing acceleration, then you have a straight line that rises. This one is probably easier to understand because it's simply showing you that speeding up steadily means a direct relationship between speed increasing with time also increasing. Another point to realize about acceleration is that since it's a changing speed in a given time, you can calculate an acceleration by knowing beginning and ending speeds anywhere along a whole movement. If you were to pick out two places anywhere in the movement where you knew two speeds and the time it took between those speeds, you could subtract the initial or starting speed from the final or ending speed and divide by the time that these two speeds took to do their changing. Thus, the formula, final speed minus initial speed divided by time. An example of how to use this formula could be a final speed of 80 meters per second minus an initial speed of 40 meters per second, which is 40 meters per second. And if the time it took to change these speeds was 5 seconds, then the acceleration would be 40 divided by 5, which equals 8 meters per second squared. As we know, things will accelerate by speeding up if they're dropped from a high place. We call this acceleration due to gravity. Isaac Newton experimented by dropping carefully measured masses from different heights and watching their impacts in clay. The cavity created from an object dropped twice as high was not twice as deep, it was more than twice, which meant that it was an exponential relationship. So after much testing, he refined acceleration due to gravity as 9.8 meters per second squared. That meant that all objects would fall to the Earth 9.8 meters per second faster each second of the fall. Each year, I demonstrate this concept by dropping two 11-meter strings off the tallest part of the school. One string has evenly spaced washers, and the other has washers spaced proportionately with a 9.8 times difference in their spacing, or exponentially separated further apart towards the top of the string. They hypothesize the rhythms that the washers will generate by the sound of clinking washers hitting the ground when the strings are dropped. We find the one with the linear spaced washers makes an exponential sound, because the washers that fell further through the air at the top sped up more, so they caught up with the others at the bottom of the drop. And the string that had the exponentially spaced washers made a linear rhythm, since they were spaced according to how much they would eventually speed up during their time aloft. Now, obviously, it's not a perfect world. So this perfectly clean sounding acceleration of 9.8 meters per second squared is muddied by dropping from really high places, like out of a plane. It turns out that air molecules will create enough resistance to slow the speed of acceleration all the way down, even to zero. That doesn't mean that you stop in midair, it just means that you stop accelerating when your weight equals the fluid friction of the air, or air resistance. Then you've reached what is called terminal velocity. For a human, it's close to 100 miles an hour depending on how much surface area you create, like with your arms out or in. So if we exclude air resistance, we can work out some simple calculations for how fast something should be falling at a given amount of seconds during a fall. For example, if something fell for 6 seconds, it should be falling 9.8 times 6, which equals 58.8 meters per second. Now, speaking of Isaac Newton and his experiments with dropping different masses, he realized that the force of the dropping object was different due to the crater depth being exponentially deeper with increasing height for each drop. It wasn't the mass of the dropping object that changed, it was the acceleration of the dropping object. So the force of an object causing a crater was as much affected by the acceleration as it was by the mass, or even more. This led to several realizations. One is that the weight of something is its mass times its acceleration, kilogram meters per second squared, otherwise known as newtons. Also, that the acceleration due to the gravity on Earth may not be the same on another planet, since our acceleration due to gravity is caused by how much mass the Earth has, and other planets don't have exactly this same amount of mass. The acceleration due to gravity on the moon is a sixth of the Earth, so you would weigh 1/6 of your Earth weight on the moon. Also, you could theoretically weigh anything, like zero, if you weren't being accelerated by gravity, like half the way between Earth and the moon, or a lot more if you were close to something really big like Jupiter or the Sun. Another widely known of Newton's experimental realizations is that all objects of any mass, if dropped at the same time, would accelerate the same amount and would therefore hit at the same time on the Earth's surface. Well, this isn't technically true because different shapes will create different amounts of wind resistance. And because if you were to drop a planet-sized object, it would probably drop towards the Earth faster because now you'd have an object you're dropping with its own acceleration due to gravity that you'd have to add to what the Earth has. This dropping of objects and calculating masses, accelerations, and depth of craters, which means a result of force, led Newton to develop his three laws of motion. The first law, inertia. All objects in motion will stay in motion forever unless acted upon by an outside force, like friction. And all objects will stay still forever unless acted upon by an outside force. The second law is about force. This came from his crater depth measurements. Mass times acceleration, or force, in newtons equals mass in kilograms times acceleration, meters per second squared. The third law is about momentum. The momentum of a closed system is conserved. An example of this third law is that the momentum before an impact equals the momentum after an impact, or the momentum of rocket fuel going out of a rocket equals the momentum of the rocket moving out to space. And momentum is mass times velocity. Thus, its units are kilogram meters per second. Many very intricate math problems can be generated from these laws, and students should be able to do some low-level algebra with F equals ma and mv before equals mv after. Forces have vector qualities. That means that they have directional components. You can pull against something, and it can pull equally and oppositely so that the two pulls are at a stalemate. That would give a net force of zero. In other words, the two forces would cancel out. You can also add a force to a direction by pushing on something already pushing in the same direction. For example, two people pushing on a car might get it to move when only one person wasn't enough. Two forces of 4 and 5 newtons both going the same direction results in a net force of 9 newtons. The common English usage of the word work is a misnomer. Like when a teacher says, get back to work, and they're implying that you should have a book open and you're paying attention to the work that you're reading or writing. Or a boss yells to the employee, get to work, and they mean sit back down at the desk. Neither of these is really work, because work is measured by the distance that a force is applied. So the units are Newton meters, or joules. If you wanted to find out how much work you did when you climbed 20 stairs, 20 centimeters high, and your weight was 200 newtons, the calculation would be 0.2 meters, this comes from the 20 centimeter stair height, times 20 because there are 20 stairs, times 200 because your weight is the force you're moving, equals 800 joules of work. Power is the work done divided by the time it took to do the work. So if you ran those stairs in 20 seconds, then your power is calculated by dividing 800 by 20, which equals 40 Newton meters, or joules per second, or watts. Now let's say that we had measured the force that a motor can generate, which equals 1 Newton. Is there a way that we could use this motor to pull something which weighs more than 1 Newton? It doesn't seem like that could be possible, but this brings into physics something called a machine. And again, common English can mess you up with what we mean by a machine. Generally, we think a machine is a loud contraption with gears made of metal. Not here. A machine is anything that changes the amount of force or a direction of a force. Okay, anything that changes the direction of the force leaves us with many possibilities, like just pulling the object across a counter rather than straight up. You might only be able to pull 1 Newton of weight straight up, but could pull 240 newtons horizontally on a tabletop if the weight was placed on wheels or something that reduced the friction by a great deal. So the tabletop itself is a machine, and the addition of wheels is another machine. These machines caused the mechanical advantage of 240. The mechanical advantage is a number without units. That means how much more work can be generated by using a machine compared to without. It's calculated by dividing the output force by the input. In other words, how much force you moved divided by the amount of force that you generated. This brings up a question. How many different ways can a force's amount or direction be changed? It turns out that there are only six possibilities. They are called simple machines. The first is an inclined plane, the mechanical advantage of which can be calculated by dividing its length by its height. So if you had a plane 6 centimeters long and it was 1 centimeter high, then its IMA, that's short for the mechanical advantage without friction, or ideal mechanical advantage, would be 6 divided by 1, which equals 6. That means without friction, you should be able to move 6 times more weight by pushing it up the plane than picking it straight up off the floor. A wedge is pretty much a plane, but it's more like two planes crammed together. And in this case, the wedge does the moving rather than something moving across its surface, like with the plane. The IMA of a wedge is simply its length divided by its width. So if you had a wedge 3 centimeters long and 1 centimeter wide, without friction, it would provide a mechanical advantage of 3. A screw is simply an inclined plane wrapped around a post. That means that you can calculate the IMA of a screw the same way that you do an inclined plane. In this case, the screw's thread length is the length of the plane, and the screw's height or length is the height of the plane. So you divide the screw's thread length by its height. So with the thread length of 3 millimeters and a screw length of 1 millimeter, then the IMA is 3. Levers are probably the most common of the simple machines. They can come in the form of almost any object. A table surface is a lever. A carrying bag is a lever. And a pencil is a lever. There are 3 types depending on where the fulcrum is located. The fulcrum is the pivoting point for the lever. The IMA can be calculated for any lever by dividing the input length by the output length. The input length is the distance from the input to the fulcrum, and the output length is the distance of the fulcrum to the output and whatever is being moved. So if you had an input length of 6 centimeters and an output length of 1 centimeter, then your IMA would be 6 divided by 1, which equals 6. The 3 types or classes of levers are: first class, the output and input move in opposite directions and the fulcrum is between them. Examples are can openers and crowbars. Second class levers have the fulcrum at one end and the input force at the other end. This means that the output force is between the fulcrum and the input force. Examples of these types of levers are staplers and wheelbarrows. The third class levers have the fulcrum at the end also and the input force between the fulcrum and the output. Examples are golf and baseball clubs, tennis rackets, and hockey sticks. A wheel and axle is a simple machine, and the IMA for this one is calculated by dividing the wheel's radius by the axle's radius. So if you had a screwdriver with a handle radius of 3 millimeters and the shaft was 1 millimeter, then the IMA would be 3. And the last of the 6 simple machines is the pulley. To find the IMA of a pulley, you simply count how many supporting strands there are for the weight being moved. Since a simple fixed pulley only has 1 supporting strand, there's no mechanical advantage. However, we all know that sometimes changing the direction that you have to pull can make all the difference in how easy it is to move something, like making a flag move up a flagpole or raising a sail. With a movable pulley, then you've got 2 strands supporting the weight, and thus you would have an IMA of 2. If you attach 2 pulleys, such that one is fixed and the other one has one end of the rope attached, the rope is looped through the fixed pulley and back through the movable one, then you would have 3 supporting strands. This setup is called a block and tackle. You can keep looping strands back around and around if you have multiple grooves in your pulleys, and this keeps adding more mechanical advantage. What if you have a machine with 2 or more simple machines that work together? Then you have what we call a compound machine. The compound machine's IMA is calculated by multiplying all of the individual IMAs of each simple machine together. So if you had a compound machine with a wedge IMA of 3 and a lever IMA of 6 and a wheel and axle IMA of 2, then you'd have a total IMA of 3 times 6 times 2, which is 36. So you should be able to move an object 36 times easier with your machine, excluding friction. Now, all of this talk about moving things and never a mention about energy. Well, it turns out that work is energy. So Newton meters or joules are a measurement of energy. And watts, or joules per second, are how much energy there was in an amount of time. That's energy's version of power. There are two basic forms of energy: kinetic, which means moving, and potential, or not moving. Energy is the ability to do work, so if something has the ability to move or cause movement, then there is energy there in the form of potential energy. Kinetic energy is calculated by mass times velocity squared divided by 2. The velocity is squared because it matters so much more than the mass. An example could be realizing how much damage a small object like a bullet can cause when it gets moving faster than the speed of sound and penetrates walls or slamming a body by its violent impact. And it's divided by 2 because it's being averaged. The potential energy of something that falls, like a skier, is calculated by multiplying the weight by the distance that it falls. This is called gravitational potential energy. Another type of potential energy is elastic. This is when the potential energy is stored, used, and then restored again. Examples are rubber bands, super balls, and shooting arrows with a bow. Probably the main thing to understand about potential and kinetic energy is how potential and kinetic energy can change into each other. They can cycle back and forth in moving objects, like pendulums and roller coasters. When the roller coaster moves slowly up a ramp and it's gathering potential energy until it reaches the top, then it has all potential energy and no kinetic energy. When it starts moving downwards, it is gaining kinetic energy and losing potential energy. Then, when it reaches the bottom of the track, it has all kinetic energy and no potential energy. But it then starts building up potential energy as it goes back up to another high point in the track. These equations and measurements of energy were used by Einstein and other famous scientists to equate matter and energy. Notice how E equals mc squared resembles the formula for kinetic energy, E equals mv squared divided by 2. And that concludes this podcast on movement physics. From Mr. Crowder's world to you.